Blog Talk Radio.
Golden dreaming beauty man, is it only fantasy? Sometimes one can't help but wonder, will it ever truly be? Some people keep on saying, all is illusion and lies. Why is it so hard to believe there are better days to see? So it seems like the world is tumbling down. It's the darkest time of night, right before dawn.
Yes, blessed souls, here comes a time of joy and love and brotherhood. Blessings and greetings, greetings and blessings. You're now tuned into the higher frequency of blogtalkradio.com. Our presentation is called Soul Class. This is Soul Class 506, Secular by Design, program presentation number 43. Blessed is our Creator. Shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the human family experience. With Creator's help, our broadcast is now taking place on July 28th. 2015, live from Turtle Island, 9:32 a.m., a.k.a. the USA Unified Soul Actualization. Program content will focus reading from Alan W. Cecil's Secular by Design, a philosophy of Noahide laws and observances, which can be purchased by going to Amazon.com and just typing in Secular by Design, a philosophy of Noahide laws and observances. Our call-in number is 347-838-8669. Happy to say we have two co-hosts on. Meanwhile, may the eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones peacefully and pleasantly. And we're now going to cue down the music from Reb Isaac Witton, blessed brother in spirit, soul, and prayer, the president of the Beit Mazal Sfarda congregation. And let's just turn on the music and get on with the show. Okay, joining me live right now is the author of Secular by Design, Philosophy, Noahide Laws, and Observances. And last time we were together, Alan, it was actually the day before Independence Day, but we're continuing to experience and express our independence by dialoguing on your book. Good morning, sir.
Oh, thank you, Don. We're going to have a really big shoe tonight.
And also joining us is Rambam teacher, student, activist for the dissemination teachings of Rambam, the Nesher Goldo, the Great Eagle, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon. My name is Dennis Ryan, who just came back from, hopefully, the friendlier shores of Europe. Good morning, Dennis.
Shalom. How are you, Alan?
I'm copacetic.
All right.
So before we go on to, with the program, Dennis, could you maybe give us an essential moment of experience? Where were you in Europe the last 2 weeks?
I was in Rome, and then I took a boat to the Greek islands and ended up in Athens. And I had a chance to see what the difference of Rome and Athens is, because Athens is the source of a lot of our problems today. But the city was created about 6,000 years before the birth of Jesus of Nazareth. And I don't think they made much improvement on the Acropolis since then. But they've spread out into the suburbs, and what I really liked was the people in the islands, because they were like insulated from everything else and just enjoying life. It's when you get into the big cities that you feel the squeezed in, the rat race, and the strangulation that's happening in our big in the world's big cities. Because in Rome, I went to the Jewish ghetto area. Now, the word ghetto began in Venice, but they used it in Rome as well, but they didn't stick all the Jews in one big basic building. They have an old area that is beautifully laid out and in nice little shops, nice little restaurants, etc. And it's just a pleasant area to walk around in. And you don't feel like you're in Rome when you're in the Jewish ghetto in Rome. But I enjoyed it. It was nice. And you can see where these people have history in front of them, their eyes. See, we don't have that in this country. We don't have what George Washington did on here, there, and everywhere, gigantic monuments and other things like that. But over there, you see remnants of history. And that's a slightly different world because you have a physical connection to it. So I guess it's hard to break this connection to see straight and fly straight.
Mm-hmm. With that being said, we're going to, so to speak, piggyback on some material that we covered, not the previous show, because the last time Dennis and Alan and I were actively on the air was on July 3rd again, and I suggest anyone who wants to go back and listen to the archive version, they can. You just have to go to Blog Talk Radio, type in my name, Donzusia Goodman, and now you have a smorgasbord of over 500 classes to choose from. And we were talking about ideas relating to the Constitution. But since Dennis brought up the civilizations of the Greeks and the Romans, we're going to start and go a little bit back into page 84 of Secular by Design, Protocols of the Philosopher, and talk about, within the context of the philosopher of the Enlightenment, show evidence the influence of the Greeks and the Romans. And Alan quoted there at that point that Voltaire found his rationalism for anti-Semitism in history. He argued that the Jews had always been despised even before Christian times. He constantly adduced pagan writers as Tacitus, Juvenal, and Cicero to prove his point. And this was published by Chaim Maccabee, Anti-Semitism and Modernity, Innovation and Continuity, which was published in 2006. And the ideas of the Enlightenment as influenced by the Greeks and the Romans, and how their ideas were combined and synthesized into a new academic model, a model that has since affected practically all theological and historical study of Israel by both the church and secular academia. Practically every non-Jewish commentary on the New Testament and every study in ancient Judaism has been affected by it, either directly or indirectly. And Alan then went on to quote another Alan, this time it was Alan Bloom from The Closing of the American Mind, where he quotes Bloom from page 253 of his book published by Simon & Schuster, 1987, quote, "Reason transformed into prejudice is the worst form of prejudice." Alan, you know, I'm thinking, you know, this past Sunday we observed, we have the Jewish nation, and for those people who are aware of it amongst the nations of the world, Tisha B'Av, which is the commemoration of the destruction of the First Temple, the Second Temple. It was also the beginning of World War II when Nazis bombed Poland with their Blitzkrieg. And the Germans certainly were well indoctrinated with reasoning as being going beyond that which is super-rational, and look at the destruction it brought upon the world, which was basically what the Greeks and Romans engaged in as well. And look at the destruction they brought into the world, unfortunately, with their colonialism and their trying to conquer the world. So, Alan, why has it taken so long for people to not get the lesson that rationalism, reasoning, which is based on rationalism, not only is just the worst form of prejudice, it leads to the greatest disasters in human history?
Well, going back to what Dennis just mentioned, if you go to Rome, one of the most colossal and impressive monuments is the Arch of Titus, which depicts the destruction of the Second Temple. And it's still there. And Right. Look at the symbolism And I can't think of a better example. I mean, you know, you're talking about building monuments to history. Here, Asabian, here in the middle, the very center of Adam, of Rome, they have this huge monument commemorating the destruction of the Second Temple. It's right there for everybody to see, and it's been there for almost 2,000 years.
Yep. Dennis?
Yes, Alan is correct, because every time the Romans conquered anything or overcame what they call a war and won, they erected monuments all over the place. And they're still there today because they commemorate things. So what happens is this warlike concept still existed that began with, let's say, Alexander the Great, that you must conquer and incorporate. And colonialization is based on that concept to a certain extent. But Alexander the Great said you must be a benign conqueror. So that's how we managed to tell people, I'm going to conquer you, but when it's done, we can still be friends. But people forget what Alexander started and the Greeks elaborated on and the Romans perfected, is that, yes, you can be warlike, but in the end, we all must live together. So as far as what Alan has been pointing out in his book, in the Age of Reason, the Age of Enlightenment, and all these wonderful, beautiful things done by humans, not by Hashem, is that they sort of subverted some of the original concepts that history says people started to do to unify. And today we're in a disarray, and we don't know how to get back to it.
True. Going further into the book, the grand ideas and concepts such as quote-unquote freedom and quote-unquote equality, as expounded by philosophers such as Voltaire, Kant, and Hegel, influenced not only the historical schools of the Enlightenment, but all branches of the social sciences. Freedom, from the rabbinical viewpoint, is not simply another theological, philosophical, or individualistic attribute or idea. But in contrast to that, we have Alan quoting from a rabbinical scholar by the name of Pnei Yeshua, and actually I googled up the name Pnei Yeshua before the program, because there's actually three rabbis go by that name, and I'm not exactly sure from which one this Pnei Yeshua quote is coming from, although the source for that is coming from Rabbi Nelson Sherman and Hirsch Goldworm's Vayikra, which is the book of Leviticus, their commentary on it from Masorah Publications, 1990, page 425. And we read this the last time we did a program together before the July 3rd program. In order for a person to appreciate freedom, he must value the freedom of others just as he values his own. Now, I just want to make a little comment on that, you know, talking about colonialism and conquering. One of the things that the ancient Romans did when they entered the land of Judea, or Israel, as we might call it today, is that they renamed the land Palestina. And for those people who want to make the accusation that Israel are colonializers or a mere proxy of the United States of America, I'd like to remind you that those who believe in the Palestinians have the right to the land are basically promoting the idea that the ancient Romans, had the right to conquer Israel and therefore rename it Palestina and then provide the fuel to the fire of these Arabs, many of them coming from Turkey, Egypt, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and Lebanon, and even as far as Iraq and Iran, to claim this is their land, when actually they are just the after deluge of the conquering of the land of Israel by the ancient Romans about over 1,900 years ago. So in contrast to that, the Pnei Yeshua was saying, if you want to understand your own freedom, you have to evaluate and value the freedom of others just as you value your own freedom. The Enlightenment concept of freedom was, first and foremost, freedom from the Torah. As Alan so wisely now quoted Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's Collected Writings, Volume 1, page 232, as Rabbi Hirsch observed, those enlightened ones, and he was talking about, I guess, those who lived in Germany, those enlightened ones make sure not to burden their children with knowledge of God, so that the children will be without scruples, without trepidation, without hesitation to follow the footsteps which the irresponsibility of their fathers had marked out for them. It is better to entrust yourself and your child to be the guidance of your God than to commit yourself and him to everyday sagacity of those thought as intelligent, whose sagacity in reality is blinded by the attractions of profit and pleasure. So the Enlightenment concept of freedom was first and foremost freedom from the Torah. It was not that the philosopher did not know about the Torah. We now come to the most damning evidence against the philosophers of the Enlightenment, the excision of the works and the teachings of Christian Hebraists, most notably John Selden. So before we get into this section, Alan, this is pretty fascinating that in the light of all that darkness called the Enlightenment movement arrives on the scene in the 17th century, this man, John Selden. It's just quite amazing that, you know, the way things were going, and all of a sudden there always seems to be one spiritual salmon who swims against the tide to try to bring a little light in the face of darkness. Any comments on that?
Well, the story of John Selden is a fascinating one, and it's just so incredible that he has been deliberately ignored, his work on the Noahide Law, because this was a man, as we're going to see, was one of the greatest scholars in a period of great scholars, people like Sir Isaac Newton, John Locke. Yet his works, although they captured the attention of a lot of people during the 17th century, they have been subsequently ignored, deliberately ignored.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's go a little further. During the 17th century, just before the Enlightenment period got underway, the Torah gained a brief but important toehold in the legal, religious, and philosophical thought of Europe, particularly in the countries of England and the Netherlands. The Christian Hebraists at the forefront of this movement were the Dutch scholar Hugo Grotius, or Grotius, who lived from 1583 to 1645, and the British lawyer John Selden, who lived from 1584 to 1654. Selden had studied the Talmud and the writings of Maimonides and concluded that the seven Noahide laws were the divine foundation of what was then being touted at the time as natural law. I'm going to quote, as Alan did, from Rabbi Eli Monk, The Call of the Torah concerning the explanations on the Book of Genesis. This is published by Masorah Publications, 1994, page 35. The relationship between natural law and the seven Noahide laws was first elucidated by John Selden, the greatest English scholar of the 17th century, in his work, and it's in Latin, so I'm going to try to do it some justice, De jure naturale et gentium juxta disciplinam, Abrirum, in 1640, natural and civil law, according to the Hebrews. He speaks of the laws of Noah, of universal obligation, application, the laws which are binding only on the Jews. And both Selden and Grotius taught that the seven laws not only provide the groundwork for national law, but international law as well. And here we see Jacob P. Rosenblatt, who Alan quoted, from Renaissance England's chief rabbi, John Selden. Grotius, and Selden would view more positively the rabbinic tradition of the Noahide law that, at least before the Sinai Theophany, provided a minimal set of moral laws that were divine and universally obligatory. Selden was one of the most erudite minds ever produced by the Western culture and did not agree with the principle of natural law derived from reason, but of positive law, a law from the supreme lawgiver. And quoting from footnote 32, from Alan's book, from quoting here, The Origins of Historical Jurisprudence by Koch, Selden, and Hale, the Yale Law Journal from 1994. Natural law theory treats law essentially as the embodiment in rules and concepts of moral principles that derive ultimately from reason and conscience. Positivism treats law essentially as a body of rules laid down, posited, and enforced by supreme lawmaking, authority, and the sovereign. So, this principle of natural law derived from reason, but of positive law, a law from a supreme lawgiver, Selden came to this view from his study of the Talmud, and like most of his contemporaries, who felt that the teachings of the Noahide Code were little more than a rabbinical flotsam in a sea of laws which Jesus had done away with. Selden saw the humaneness and reason in the rabbinical teachings that softened the very often harsh legal pronouncements in the written Torah. An example of this would be penalty for sleeping with another man's wife. A person who violates law is technically to be put to death, yet for a man to be convicted of this punishment, the rabbis ruled that there would have to be a set of circumstances so precise that would make the death penalty all but impossible, that there would have to be two witnesses, and just prior to the violation, the law must be spoken to the potential violator exactly as written in the Torah. And this would be like having two policemen giving the Miranda warning to a criminal just before he commits the crime, a scenario that would be highly unlikely. So, Alan, this is the frustration, because people only read the written law. They want to, you know, the classic bumbling misinterpretation of an eye for an eye, tooth for the tooth, is all talking about monetary damages and restoration for damages that another person incurs at the hand of the person who causes the damage. So there was a light, there was a door that opened, and we're talking about two men who lived in the 17th century, way before the American Revolution, who squashed their attempts to make these teachings more well known.
I just wanted to point out you missed footnote number 33. It was right after footnote 32. It might be an interesting one to read.
Okay, so I'll read that. And then, so this is quoting from Nud Hakonsen, Natural Law and Moral Philosophy, from Grotius to the Scottish Enlightenment, Cambridge, University Press, 1996, page 30. Selden took the idea of man's natural freedom from moral laws a great deal further than Grotius. So far, in fact, that according to him, the only way in which moral community could be understood was as an effect of God's positive imposition and enforcement of the moral law as promulgated in the precepts given to the sons of Noah. So that is a very potent, you really brought a lot of potent footnotes here, Alan, but again, why were their ideas squashed? I mean, they had the knowledge, they had the ability, I'm sure, to elucidate, since Selden was a lawyer, and I'm sure that this Grotius was also a man of words. What crushed their efforts
to become more
wide known back then?
Well, that has a lot to do with what I wrote about earlier in this chapter on philosophy. Anti-Semites like Voltaire, who hated the Jews, and just the whole theme of the Enlightenment, they were trying to get away from the church, you know, reduce the power of the church. And they saw anything religious, such as, you know, the Bible, the Torah, as something they needed to put down and not deal with. They began a movement to go back to the ancient Greek and Roman, basically, you know, the Arsuvian roots, to come up with a moral system.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, any comments on these matters?
Yes, we've been talking about principles, morals, and laws. Sometimes they're not interchangeable, even though we may label them that way, but they're really not. And that's one of the reasons why these people wanted freedom, to get away from the Bible, per se, because they wanted freedom to think and come out with things in their mind, and they weren't accepting the principles and the morals that were already established in the Bible. So what happens, Alan here is saying, well, or let me paraphrase Alan one step further, and that is, if you're not going to follow the Bible, what are you going to do to replace it with? Humans are still thinking about how to come up with great ideas and use them in place of principles, morals, and laws. But the ideas are personal ideas, and we don't have enough people to agree on these same ideas. But we do know our source for principles and morals hasn't changed. So therefore, anybody who says, me, have a great idea, that's fine, but that's personal.
Mm-hmm. Let's go a little bit further, gentlemen. We're getting coming close to the end of today's presentation, which is flying like lightning, escaping from the bottle of ideas. Selden not only had a penchant for thinking. Actually, no, I have to go back. I'm at the right place. Selden not only had a penchant for thinking outside the box, but he championed the concept of the importance of primary sources. As Charles A. Beard would comment, quote, "One thing, however, my masters taught me, and that was to go beyond the pages of history written by contemporaries and read the sources." So here we have three footnotes by Alan. One is footnote 34. Selden's most controversial uses of philology occur in his scholarly works, particularly in his treatises on Jewish law, where he explains disputed New Testament terms in the light of ancient Jewish institutions. This method is standard today. In the 17th century, it verged on heresy, and that was written by Martha A. Ziskin. John Selden, Criticism and Affirmation of the Common Law Tradition, published from the American Journal of Legal History, Volume 19, Number 1, January 1975, page 32. Footnote 35, quoting Ziskin again, was one facet of Selden's critical attitude towards text is his preference for primary over secondary sources. And when we quoted Charles A. Beard, or at least Allen did, this is from An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States, published by Transaction Publishing, 1998, New Brunswick, New Jersey. I guess it's page 19 or forward page. Maybe it was the beginning of the book, because he has these Roman numerals which would seem to equal the value of 19. Selden's simple but profound reasoning led him to understand that since the Noahide law was the original legal code God had given to mankind, and I, as a Jew, agree with that one, and since the Jews were the keepers and transmitters of this ancient law, which I do agree, reason dictated that the Noahide law as expounded by the rabbi should be the basis for all legal systems, which I would certainly promote. Noahide law predated Roman law, and Selden believed that neither the principles of natural law could be deduced wholly from the civil law of Rome, nor could be a case made for the universality of Roman law throughout history. And there he quotes Ziskin and John Selden's Criticism and Affirmation of the Common Law Tradition, page 37. There were many matters of Roman law and English common law, and even where, quote-unquote, national custom and Roman law came into conflict, national custom prevailed. Selden discusses in detail the triumph of common law over efforts to establish Roman law as the law of England. And there he's quoting again from Ziskin's John Selden, Criticism and Affirmation of the Common Law. Roman law had an indelible and lasting impact on the English common law, which meant, since we know that the American Constitution and the Declaration of Independence certainly grafted some concepts which the revolutionaries, or the people who formulated the revolution, so basically what we have in America is a transplantation of early Roman and Greek reasoning, although he doesn't mention Greek reasoning here. Certainly we know from the just the architecture that we see surrounding, or actually the actual foundations of many of the nation's capital's buildings, we see that at least, if not just architecturally, somewhere down the line we can also distill out sources within American law and reasoning based on natural law, based on rationalism, which dates back to ancient Greece and ancient Rome, even though there are those who say that America was predicated upon many Judaic and Christian values, which one could also argue as well. But it's, you know, when you throw many ingredients into a pot, bless its souls, it has a unique taste. But, you know, to understand why it has a unique taste, you have to sort of deconstruct that pot of stew to realize why each ingredient gave the taste it did. So we do see a mixture of some sort of Judaic principles in, say, the formulation of Western society, Western civilization, but it's also been, so to speak, adulterated by natural law, human reasoning, with the intent of purging out the influences which hopefully speed in all days, which is the universal application, implementation, even on the most secular level, of the seven universal commandments. Alan?
Yeah, and the thing with, you look at the English common law and our American legal system, which is derived from English law, they both use Latin as their legal terminology. Latin, which of course is the language of Rome, / Adam.
Yep. But I mean, do you agree with me, Ellen, or you can disagree as well, that we also see Greek ideals integrated into American civilization?
Oh, absolutely. That's a subject I do later on in the book in Chapter 5. I go through that very thoroughly, how our whole legal system and our ideas, our nation, was founded on Greek and Roman principles, morals, values, whatnot.
Right. And Dennis, I wouldn't be surprised with your comment when I ask you the following question. You were in Greece and Rome, And yet you come back to America and we're discussing how their ideas have distilled even into this quite modern civilization of only 400 years, or say since the Declaration of Independence, 239 years. Any comments about this matter?
Yes, the Europeans just fall in line. They don't really question what's there because they have all these physical memorials all over the place. They got these things that were built 2,000, 3,000 years ago, and they're still there. So these people are visualizing it physically, what was done in the past. And they can't judge it by saying, oh, it's bad or anything like that, because it's theirs. It's in front of them. But we have to remember the word common and ideal has been kicked around all over the place since the Roman and Greek civilizations controlled things. However, it all comes down to, and this is, I got to summarize Alan's book to a certain extent. He may not agree, but I'm going to give you my opinion, and that is, we have ideals. We have God's ideals, and we have humans' ideals. Which one are you going to choose?
Very good. Alan, any essential point you'd like to share with our audience today? One seminal point of the Sevenoid Commandments that you'd like to share with them, how they can try to experience it, integrate or implement it into daily life, even this day.
Well, I've got 7 points, actually. it's hard to pick just one. I keep harping on this, but you know, the only way people are going to understand this is to educate themselves. You're not going to find it in our traditional academic system. They have that, and that's what these first few early chapters of my book talk about. They have kept the knowledge of the Torah out. They have, and I can't think of a better example than the teachings of John Selden, as we'll get into, I guess, next week, a little more thoroughly. But you know, they have deliberately kept this man out of our academic discussion, and that has, you know, they say, well, they say things, you know, well, you know, the Torah must not be important because no one had ever talked about it, which is wrong. Someone did talk about it, John Selden, one of the most brilliant minds in Western history. So that argument really falls flat. This was a deliberate attempt to keep this knowledge unknown.
True. I just like to piggyback off that and even say something which might sound even a little controversial in some circles, is that for those of you blessed souls who are the children of Noah, it does not suffice just to hear a rabbi's speech, any rabbi's speech. You have to go into the books yourselves. You have to open up the text material. As we just read as Charles A. Beard quoted, you have to go beyond presentations made to you, even a presentation like this, and go to the source material. This is someone like Rabbi Shamshon Mofrol Hirsch. You can go to there. You Google up a smorgasbord of subject matter. Hopefully you'll get the good stuff and not the bad stuff about the 7 9 commandments, which will talk about what your obligations are to the Creator and to your fellow human being. And then you have to come to make your own decision, because after all, we all are given free choice. And we all must accept upon ourselves that whatever we do in our lives, good or the opposite of good or something in between, there are consequences for our thoughts, speech, and actions. And the 7 9 commandments are tailored in such a way that no one's asking you to get involved in any super rational thinking. It's all about using the human intellect. And as Dennis mentioned before, the human ideal, and then there's the God's ideals. The whole idea is to elevate the human ideal to be configured to the frequency of the divine ideal or the God's ideals, which are way beyond ours. But when we get drop by drop, molecule by molecule of information, we become more informed about what our purpose is, what is the purpose of the creation. Hopefully we can formulate a plan together as part of the entire human family experience, not just the Jewish people, not just the children of all, but all of us working together to make this world in a way of Ahav Echad, one love, Goral Echad, one destiny kolano for all of us. Berdar Chinom, Dar Kishom, in a pleasant and peaceful way. We're going to conclude today's programming with this ending segue music of David Dohm, Make It Better, because after following Tisha B'Av, the lesson to be learned out of the destruction of the First and Second Temple, and also the beginning of the Second World War, that there's certainly a better way to make it. than the painful lessons of history which occurred on that day 2 days ago historically, not only for the nation of Israel, but for all the nations of the world, especially 76 years ago approximately. And let's just try to make it better, blessed souls. Remember, you've got a divine image who helps you get scrimmage. And remember, you've got to be good. You can be good because Ateva Tov Lehitiv, the nature of the good to do good, the Creator is the source of all good. So go ahead and make it better. Thank you very much, gentlemen, and take care, blessed souls. Until next time, this is Soul Class with Dunzo Sio Goodman, and let's take it away, David Dome.
Kill the hate so they can live.